Well, we're talking with Dr. Keith Scott Mumby. He's the author of the book called Virtual Medicine. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Keith Scott Mumby. Keith, first of all, where do you get the book, Virtual Medicine?
It's available through Borders, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon.com. Also, if any of your listeners go onto my website, your website gives the link. If you go onto my website, there's a link there. You can buy it directly from me. I have to be honest and tell you, Amazon, I think, is the cheapest. They sell it cheaper than I do.
They do. They do move product, don't they?
Indeed, yes. Any one of those places, anyway.
This incredible look at alternative medicine. I have always believed that this planet has got to be alive, because at least almost every cure, and I'm beginning to think maybe every cure for every illness or disease, is on this planet. And what puzzles me, though, Keith, is why? How would a planet know, for example, that, let's say, the willow bark, where you can make aspirin, is used for all kinds of purposes, you know, becoming a wonder drug of this civilization. How does the planet do that?
George, I'm not sure I understand your question. Just rephrase it, please.
Well, you know, people have diseases.
Yes.
The planet has remedies for most of these diseases.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I see where you're leading. That's an old Indian, what's the word? A maxim, isn't it? That whenever there's disease present, the cure for it is nearby. I think it all has to do with energies and vibrations, that every substance, which includes living things and plants, but also chemical and biochemical substances within them and around us, all have unique electromagnetic energy signatures, frequency signatures. This touches on the work of Jacques Benveniste. Do you remember The Memory of Water Man?
Yes.
Before he died, sadly he died about 18 months ago, but the last thing he was working on was being able to encode the signatures of different substances. He put them through transducers, got them into a computer on a digital form, and was able to send them over the internet, email attachments and, you know, down the telephone wires. These were decoded in another place, and usually universities, and I'm talking respectable science here, but when the signature was decoded, then you actually got the performance of the drug or the substance, but there was none of it there. So again, it's kind of virtual medicine, isn't it? There is no substance. There's just a virtual substance, and yet it has these pharmacological effects. So it seems to me pretty clear that we're living in a whole electromagnetic environment. We're receiving massive frequencies that we're exposed to, some of which are interacting, and some of them create their own kind of automatic other side, if you like, or their antithesis. I've forgotten what the term is in wave technology. An inversion of the wave. So I don't think it's any surprise that if you get one waveform present, then you get its inversion somewhere around in the environment, in some part of the planet anyway. That's how I see it in energetic terms, certainly. I mean, the bigger issue is a philosophical one, about, you know, why God would give us disease, never mind giving us remedies to go with them. But that's not really my issue.
It is out there, though. You just have to find it. And it is remarkable.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
You write about the Vega machine in your book. What is that?
Well, to explain why the Vega machine is a good idea, let's go back a little bit before that. And let's drop in to pay a visit on Chinese traditional medicine, because I mentioned that, or the crossover that's featured in this book. Chinese traditional medicine has a long history. It goes back thousands of years, but various people have tackled the science of it in the 20th century. One of the remarkable figures is a German chap called Reinhold Voll. He started out with a simple ohm meter. He called it a Dermatron, but he found that if you wander around over the skin, there are certain places where resistance will drop. Normally, the dry skin has a resistance of about a million ohms, or 2 million ohms, sorry. But in certain places, it drops to 100,000 ohms. And these spots actually coincide with the Chinese acupuncture points. So there's something different about the skin at that point. In fact, let me just tell you quickly, another device I put into virtual medicine is something called an AcuVision. And that's really awesome. We can charge a person. The person holds the electrodes, and we charge them up to about 50,000 volts. It's very low current, of course. Mm-hmm. Turn the lights down, and if we put a dielectric over the skin, you can see the acupuncture points light up. There's a stream of blue biophotons coming out of the skin at the point where the Chinese said these acupuncture... I have no idea how they knew that. They didn't have an acuvision. They didn't even have a simple ohm meter. But they figured out where these are. Anyway, Reinhold Voll investigated in the 50s and 60s and 70s. His system eventually became known as electroacupuncture, according to Voll. And it's a fascinating system. It says you can not only test meridians. For example, you can test, say, the liver meridian. You might detect what's called an indicator drop, meaning it doesn't hold its energies very well. That might suggest some pathology. But we can actually go further than that and test remedies that might get rid of that indicator drop. So that the inference is that that remedy would help, you know, that it cancels the negative indicator signal, and therefore it's likely to be a successful remedy. All of that came from Voll's work. It's really very fascinating. The trouble is it was rather laborious. In its original form, it used to take many hours to test something like 600 acupuncture points. That got narrowed down to a much faster system, but it would still take a couple of hours and still meant the patient semi-undressed. You know, you'd be exploring meridians partway up the arm, partway up the legs.
Sure.
In the 70s, a chap called Helmut Schimmel had the bright idea of saying, well, let's not just use different acupuncture points. Let's use one acupuncture point, but test it with different organ preparations. So the probe would always go on the same spot on the skin, but you'd put to it or connect it in the circuit with, say, some liver tissue, lung tissue, thymus tissue, you know, all the different organs. And on this system, you would get the indicator drop when the liver tissue was put in. So that would tell you there was some problem with the liver. And again, you would look for the remedy that might eliminate that negative drop. It was a great idea. And both of these systems, they both belong to a scheme called EAV, or electroacupuncture, according to Voll. Schimmel's is only really an outspring of that. But it leads to, typically, it leads to therapies in a dimension that we call complex homeopathy. It's not quite like ordinary homeopathy. They tend to be mixtures and remedies that are organ-based. But it's a whole discipline to itself. And a very useful one. I found it extremely good. You know, I had a Vega machine in the 80s. But one of the problems that eventually grew on me, and it does with everybody who uses one of these machines, is that you begin to realize that your own thoughts will influence it. And it's back to what I was saying about consciousness and the quantum domain. And in fact, it got so bad that people would have to try and, you know, think of something else or hum a tune while they were testing in order to not think anything that would adversely influence the system. And eventually, to be honest, I just sold it because I called it electromagnetic dowsing. I mean, I thought, well, if my intuition or my conscious thoughts are influencing the machine like this, I may as well just go with the intuition, go with what I already know. So I never used a Vega machine after that.
Do you believe that there's an ability to tap into the universe for this ability?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I'd like to tell you about an interesting device that actually is in this stable. It's called the QXCI, and it's the CI part stands for consciousness interface. Instead of struggling with the problem, it's actually made a virtue out of it. And the way I've written about it in Virtual Medicine is basically to say that the real detector is the operator. The machine is not really relevant. But this device, the QXCI, or I think it's marketed as the EPFX here in the States, has a great capability for detecting in this sort of way, you know, using the acupuncture model, using the complex homeopathy model. And it's quite shameless about saying it's really just consciousness anyway. It looks like it's a machine, but the machine is just an interface. And I've seen very good results with that too. It's, you know, I don't have one, but I think it's a great device, and I know some people who are really, you know, masters at using that and get very, very good results.
Well, that is there's something though about this alternative energy medicine that science should catch up with, but they're not. Why aren't the mainstream scientists, mainstream medicine, dealing with this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's tempting to go the old, you know, use the old bitch and say it's all controlled by the drug industry and so on. But actually, I think the problem is more subtle than that. I think that basically doctors don't know enough advanced physics. I mean, some would say they don't seem to know much medicine either, but that's another story. But advanced physics really is the secret. I have a colleague in Manchester. He's retired now, but a professor in Manchester, England. He used to say alternative medicine is really just advanced physics. if you know the advanced physics, it's not such a problem. But unfortunately, because of specialization, doctors just don't get exposed to that enough. They don't, you know, they don't know the physics, and therefore it looks strange. You know, field effects and non-locality and all these things all exist in the quantum domain. We know they have a sound scientific basis. I mean, of all the things that's really proved itself, quantum physics has proved itself, you know, even better than Einstein's relativity. Some cracks have begun to appear in the relativity equations. It may not hold up any more than Newtonian physics has actually held up, but quantum physics is certainly holding up at the moment. And remember, as I said before, consciousness is in that. So these are very radical ideas for doctors who are brought upon Newtonian physics. But, you know, physics doesn't just say these things could happen. It actually says that they must happen. You know, if you take the issue of survival after death, for example, I don't want to tread on anybody's beliefs. I'm not saying anything about what happens to the soul or the body or anything like that. But what is for sure, physics says must happen, is that you survive as an energy and information field. And if it's possible to access or trigger that field in some way, then you get a manifestation that is apparently like, you know, the reemergence of a being or an entity who had lived. That's, that much is physics, you know, regardless of what you believe in the philosophic and religious sense.
You write in Virtual Medicine that we have the means, for example, to listen for radio signals of a rabies virus with incredible ability. I've also read, Keith, that there are some practitioners who use healing gems or stones to heal people. Now, how does that work, and what is that all about?
Right. That's not so strange either, if you think of the physics. I mean, most crystals, well, think of the crystal radio, right? Crystals have a tremendous effect on electromagnetic radiation.
Oh, that's true.
They can condense it or deflect it, or modulate it in various ways. So crystal healing isn't such a strange idea. A more interesting one that's perhaps a little harder to grapple with is one using gems to influence light. It's called Ayurvedic gem therapy. It's been popular in India for centuries. But a guy in England came up with a rather brilliant idea of mixing it with electronics. What he's doing is putting these gems and crystals in the pathway of light and then shining it into the tissues. And it does seem as if the light is somehow stressed up with the qualities of the gem. For example, in that tradition, that Ayurvedic tradition, emerald and sapphire are felt to be cooling and calming. So if you shine light through emeralds and sapphires and shine it onto inflamed tissues such as eczema or a painful inflammation or a curly knee, it seems to calm it, and it does work. But he had an additional really quite brilliant idea, which was to couple this with brain frequencies. You know the different kinds of brain frequencies. Theta particularly is restful. It's a sort of semi-trance, shamanic state, dreamlike state. Low alpha is pretty relaxing, but the person, you know, stays pretty aware outwardly. Delta is unconsciousness or sleep, so that's a great painkiller, of course. So if you start to play around with these things, for example, you could shine into the head, and I say into the head because it goes straight through the bone. If you shine light into the skull that is calmed with the qualities of emerald and sapphire and give it a theta frequency, which is about 3 to 5 hertz, the person will literally pass away into a wonderful, blissful trance. We christened it Samadhi, although that really means something else in Indian philosophic lore, but it seems like a good word because it means bliss. And that's pretty well what it feels like, and it's a great treatment or a great preliminary to other more specific treatments. All this is about using crystals or gems to modulate electromagnetic energies, and it's, as I say, it's pure physics, really. It isn't so mysterious as it might sound.
Has science used some of those techniques to build some high-speed equipment that you would find in hospitals today?
Well, one of the stories I told in Virtual Medicine, in fact, I kicked off with it pretty near the beginning, is a great historic story. And it's an American doctor, one of your greatest of all American physicians, in my view, a guy called Albert Abrams. And he realized that between 1910, 1920, 25, he was working with energy radiations from tissues. And he realized that you could actually specifically detect the frequencies, the resonance frequencies of diseases like sarcoidosis, cancer, syphilis. In fact, he even made a category, an inventory of what all these different frequencies were and what they correlated to. It was all far too shocking and early for its day. And in fact, he was denounced in 23 consecutive editions of Scientific American. I think that's pretty awesome.
God. 23 straight issues?
Yeah, that is shaking the foundations of science, man. He really upset them. But I got around to investigating what he did. Oh, by the way, there was a corollary to that story, which is a guy called William Boyd, who was a homeopath in Glasgow on the British side of the pond. He decided to follow through the experiment and found out the same thing. He built himself a machine called an emanometer, and he found exactly what Albert Abrams had found, that, you know, there are specific radiation frequency emanations that associate with diseases, and also that if you put the right remedy with them, that those emanations will disappear. So, you know, obviously inferring a healing potential. So I had to ask myself, what exactly had Albert Abrams discovered? And I believe I'm the first person to say in print, I know what it was. It's a phenomenon called cyclotron resonance. It's difficult to describe just in words, you know, without some visuals. But basically it means a fixed magnetic field and an oscillating magnetic field working across that. Well, we're all in a fixed magnetic field, and that's a geomagnetic field. So any kind of tissue with oscillating emanations is capable of providing the cross oscillation. So biologically speaking, again, physics says it can't not happen. It must happen that we're exposed to cyclotron resonance conditions in our biology and makeup. So I wrote that whole story in the book, and I think it makes a great start to the unfolding of the virtual medicine story.
And this was in the this was in the 20s, you're saying, without really sophisticated equipment.
His book was published in 1911. He was from San Francisco, and this guy was no intellectual lightweight. Let's be clear about this. He was president of the San Francisco Chirurgical Association. That's the surgeons. He'd been to Europe. He was from a wealthy family. He'd paid his own ticket to go to Europe and studied medicine with the top doctors of the day, Wassermann and Helmholtz, Virchow, and all these people. He met them. And he was a very serious physician. He was a professor of surgery in one of the, I think he was at Stanford. Anyway, he was certainly a very well-connected orthodox doctor. But because he discovered this, of course, he found himself crashed in the end. But he did this, quite clearly, the phenomenon was cyclotron resonance. The so-called Abrams reflex only works if the person's feet is pointing towards the west. Well, of course... Yeah, it's true, but that means it gets scoffed at. conventional science just laughs and won't even begin to take it seriously. But look, if it's cyclotron resonance, it makes sense, George. That's the beauty of all this. That's what right. I did with virtual medicine. It. You get the right model, and it starts to make sense. And what I'm leading to saying, because it's the kind of question you led off with, is that, in fact, cyclotron resonance has now come home to roost in conventional medicine. When I was in Italy a few years ago, I first saw a device that was a cyclotron resonance detector that was capable of recognizing the signal of testicular cancer. All you had to do was put it near somebody's testicles. You didn't have to touch anything or photograph anything. It would listen for the frequencies and say, aha, this guy, you better check him out. That's what the detector devices can do. And you know, the Mayo Clinic, the famous Mayo Clinic, a couple of years ago installed a cyclotron resonance machine. Where all these pioneers went and where alternative medicine has been leading, now eventually conventional medicine is having to follow. And the reason is simple, George, and that is it's science. It's pure science. You can't fight it. You know, this is not hairy-fairy stuff. It's science. And so conventional medicine must follow.
You know, they've got these machines now that will look at the calcification in your arteries, and it's like a quick 10-minute electronic test, and you just go through this scanner and you're done, and they can project to you how much calcification you've got. And of course, obviously, the more you have, the more I believe you have hardening of the arteries, and at least you can try to take care of it.
That's right, yes. I mean, early diagnosis, of course, should be one of the main pillars of medicine, but unfortunately isn't. But it's really neat. You know, I said, you quoted me as saying you can detect the rabies virus. You can detect anything. I simply told a good story there where a woman who was sick and had diarrhea got to see a person with one of these alternative machines. It was actually a Vega machine. And he picked up the signal of rabies and said to this lady, he didn't frighten her by saying, well, I think you've got rabies, which would have been a crazy thing to say. He just said, have you been abroad? Because we don't have rabies in the UK. And she said, oh, I've been to India. And he said, well, okay, did you make contact with any animals or anything like that? Anyway, what actually emerged in the end was that she'd been feeding dogs at the back door of the hotel, just feeding them food scraps and stuff, and one of them must have licked her hand, and she must have licked her own fingers and then swallowed the virus. Now, you probably know rabies is deadly, but it has to break the skin, and it travels to the brain through the nerves. if you swallow it, it raised hell. I mean, she had very severe diarrhea. But no doctor in his right mind would think of rabies as a possible cause of diarrhea. But it was, and the Vega machine said, give her this remedy, she'll be fine, and she was. Within a week, she'd stopped vomiting and diarrhea, and she gained weight and made a full recovery. That's how these machines are capable of acting. And it's
I want to talk with you more about this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.
I got to tell you, I'm into all these devices and machines. They're fantastic. I got to read up more. The book is called Virtual Medicine. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Dr. Keith Scott Mumby, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Dr. Keith Scott Mumby. Keith, also, let's talk a little bit, if we can, about what you write about. I'm very fascinated with, you know, your arteries. And man, if those go, you go. You write about that in Hidden Patches of Infection. I wonder if it echoes an earlier interview I did. So I'm curious just to see what your take is on that.
On arterial disease?
Yes.
Well, of course, that's something that has its own particular energy signal too, and you can pick up the cyclotron resonance message or the radio frequency message, whatever. But the important thing is that it can be there years and years before there's any actual physical pathology, and that's really quite important. If you know that you're destined to get a disease if you don't do anything, it's a great time to act. Particularly, that's important with possibly fatal problems like a tumor. But it can apply to any kind of medicine that the signal, the energy disturbance predates, in fact, the information predates the energy disturbance, and then the actual physical disease follows on that. So I think it's very important to get people tested on these devices first before they even go off for their calcium arterial screening and those kind of things.
But you believe in that too, don't you?
Oh, yes, of course. None of this is meant to entirely supplant conventional medicine. It's another way around the problem. And it's working much, much further upstream. The idea, is to work. If you've got a polluted river, there's not really much point in trying to clean up the water down at the mouth of the river. It's better to walk upstream and find the factory that's causing the pollution and shut it down. And that's really what this kind of alternative approach is in these devices. So, if a person is way downstream, then they're going to need that kind of help.
And then you can clean it up.
Exactly, yes. You still need to go back up and clean the factory, of course. Don't forget that.
You talk about negative energy. Give me your take on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, logically, there are energies that don't do as much good as well as energies that can be healing. By and large, I'm talking here or thinking about exogenous energies, the endogenous energies that the body supplies, with mostly what we've been talking about. But we live in an environment that's a great sea of energies, the cosmic energies and the solar energies and the Gaia energies. All of these things must create an impact, and some of them don't serve us very well at all. In fact, I said in virtual medicine that Gaia is not necessarily as friendly as people think it is. We'd be fried in seconds if it weren't for the upper layer, the ozone layers, and the Van Allen belt, and these different layers in the stratosphere. Life would be unsurvivable down here. But also, we've encountered, and particularly, I must say, the Vega machine was one of the key machines in detecting this phenomenon. We now have an understanding of something that we call geopathic stress, which is that there can be energies coming from the Earth's surface which are quite harmful. I was first introduced to it when I went to Ireland. I did some clinics there, and there are folk who really believe in things like intuition and second sense and telepathy. But dowsing is pretty big over there, and a guy told me stories about people who would douse a house at a distance and mark black spots on the map of the house, and if people were sleeping there or living there, unless they moved around, they would be ill. And if they did move around and switch the bed or change the furniture so that they avoided these black spots, they'd get well. So I was fascinated by the stories. I took them at face value and wanted to know more about the science that's behind them. And in fact, again, they're science. Although we're talking dowsing and it might seem sort of strange and kind of hairy-fairy, in fact, you can, once you've got these spots detected, you can carry a TV monitor across them and watch the picture go fuzzy. So there really are energetic disturbances that are, you know, real-time things, in other words. They're not imaginary in any sense. And these can disturb the body and cause ill health. I think farmers, I was a country boy in England, and I was raised on a farm, and I think farmers have known for a long time that there are bad lands or bad territories. You know, the cattle just get sick. And what they usually do, of course, is sell that land, and then it's bought up by property developers, build houses.
Right.
And humans live on these bad lands instead and get sick. So it is important to detect this phenomenon if it exists. But now it's been broadened to cover what you might call pollution, really, I guess, electrical pollution, you know, spillover from microwaves and radio waves and all these man-made devices. I mean, we're now facing background radiation millions of times what natural radiation was. Even while we're talking, you know, the New York Stock Exchange is going right through our bodies. That these things are ever-present everywhere and at really quite biologically significant levels. So it must have an effect. So I'm sure these effects are compounding. They're getting worse all the time. And it's really a problem. So and these kind of endogenous or unhealthy energies, we lump them together as geopathic stress, but you know, at the Earth or Gaia isn't always just to blame. Most of them are man-made now, in fact.
You would not live next to a power line, would you?
Under no circumstances, no. One of the simplest things you can do to convince yourself of that is just get an ordinary fluorescent tube from Home Depot or somewhere like that and go and stand 100 yards from those overhead power lines, and you'll see the tube begin to glow. And the closer you get, the brighter it glows. You can get drenched in a building which is nearby one of these electrical interchanges. Very, very big problem. And, of course, you know, microwaves, the ovens and the cell phones and things, there's a huge controversy going on about these. Not enough science. I mean, there's enough science to be worried and point to the problem, but not enough science to definitively silence the critics, unfortunately, at this stage. But, you know, something will have to be done. We can't go on increasing these energy radiation levels without suffering some kind of consequences.
Well, they say that children now are starting to have hearing problems because of all these new electronic devices.
That's right. Well, the children are particularly susceptible, and their blood-forming systems particularly. There seems to be an incidence of leukemia related to overhead cables and also tumors, because it's probably basically the immune system is very sensitive, and a number of scientific tests are quoted in Virtual Medicine have shown that even the tiniest field can have a disturbing effect on T-cell function. And the consequences of that could be catastrophic.
What do some of your mainstream doctors say about all of this? Do they think you've gone over to the other side and you've abandoned them, or what?
Well, I'll be quite honest, George, I've hardly talked to a conventional doctor in 40 years. I'm just a lost cause to my medical school colleagues, although I have been in touch with them recently on the sort of, you know, the reunion front. But no, I mean, things move very, very slowly in medicine. I mean, when anesthetics were first discovered to be effective, some doctors went on for 20 years cutting off legs without anesthetics. You know, they didn't want any of this newfangled nonsense, which is pretty cruel. But it's really a sign of what the medical profession is like. There's this peculiar resistance to change. But sooner or later, you know, progress is made. I think it was... I've forgotten the French philosopher. Anyway, there's a saying that came from him, which I think is something like the first position is you must be crazy, and then the second position is, well, it sounds crazy, but there might be something in it, and then position three is, well, we've known this all the time anyway, we've known it all along, and science seems to struggle through these different stages of progress, and it's the same with alternative medicine, as I said, from denouncing Albert Abrams as a fraud to the fact that the Mayo Clinic has now got a device that is based on exactly the same principle, shows that conventional progress will eventually get there. It just depends, of course, how good the alternative ideas are. But if they work, they're based on good observations and basically sound science, then sooner or later, convention has to catch up with it.
What do you think of chelation therapy?
I used to do chelation therapy. I think it has a place. I think we're overloaded with toxic heavy metals. I think one of the number one health problems that we all face now is heavy metal poisoning. At least six of those metals are known to be cancerous. Our bodies are loaded with them. So chelation is a way of getting it out. I'm not sure now whether you mean, you know, intravenous chelation as an anti-aging procedure, you know, having it every week and feeling younger and so on. Did you mean that, or did you mean...
Well, overall,
chelating. There's also chelation therapy now to clean out your arteries as well.
Yes, that, I wondered if you perhaps meaning that. Yes, that's the sort of anti. As I say, I used to run a clinic. I used to do a lot of that. I don't do it here now. I'm not practicing here in the States.
Did you see a difference though in your patients?
Oh, most often. Not always though. Sometimes it was baffling. The person's symptoms didn't seem to clear. Certainly, we know. I mean, the old model for that was, you know, that it cleans out the plaques. That's what we used to tell ourselves in the 70s and 80s. I'm not sure that stands up to science, because certainly there wasn't much, really much evidence of that. But the person would certainly feel better. You know, they would feel extraordinarily well. I've even seen people come back from the sort of periphery of Alzheimer's. I've seen them, you know, wake up and become lucid again as they get more oxygen supply to the brain.
New research is saying that some of this plaque might also be is nanobacteria with the calcium. So one of the things that they're doing with chelation therapy, and quite successfully, is they're also zapping this with antibiotics at the same time. So they break down the calcium, and then they kill the nanobacteria with the antibiotics, and apparently it's done some remarkable things for people.
Right, that's true. I mean, that model of inflammation is now, I mean, I was reading it in Scientific American a few years ago. It's a well-accepted model now, that atheromatous plaques really start as a process of inflammation. Certain organisms, certain herpes viruses and chlamydia are rather notorious for doing that, you know, getting under the radar of the immune system, setting up the inflammation process, and the plaque is just a response to that. But what I was going to go on to say, just as the sort of last sense, as it were, of chelation, is that I think what we've realized now in the last 10 years or less, actually, is that the big dollops of plaque in the arteries are not really what kills people. It's a sudden, small, rather tiny biological storm that takes place on the lining of the arteries, which produces a sudden and catastrophic clot, and that the big plaques are actually less of a problem than we thought, simply because, I suppose, the heart and the circulation is forced to find alternative pathways.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative pathways already exist, collateral circulation, as it's called. But people will still die of sudden heart attack if they have one of these minor clotting processes that's really got nothing to do with the plaques themselves.
It is amazing what your body will do to fight back.
Absolutely. There's so much disease is fighting back. And in fact, Hippocrates was the first person to say that. He said that the whole of disease is the fight back process. If you didn't have the fight back, you'd just die. But a more subtle take on that is Ilya Prigogine. I don't know if you know his work, but he got a Nobel Prize for writing about dissipative structures. And all he was saying, really, was that life, it doesn't seem to be quite following the usual entropy pattern of just running down towards, you know, the end of the universe and oblivion. In fact, it rather seems to be going the other way. And if you look at evolution, in fact, evolution shouldn't have happened. There's no way evolution should happen if physics and entropy were the only thing that rules the universe, because evolution is becoming more organized and more complex. And yet the rest of the universe at the same time is becoming less organized and more random and more chaotic. What Ilya Prigogine pointed to is that perturbation is the key to getting better organized. And disease is a perfect example of that. If you don't perturb the body or perturb the biological system, produce some kind of disease process, then you don't get better organized, you don't get better health, you don't get better immune systems. You know, it's like as if the system kind of needs gingering up. And again, there's a good model for that in these perturbative systems. So maybe disease isn't such an awful thing. I mean, it's an awful thing to suffer, and it's an awful thing to suffer chronic disease. But it does have a place. Nature was not stupid. You know, the overall creator of things didn't just play a cruel and mindless joke on us. There is some point in the disease process.
You are not a believer in vaccines, are you?
No, I'm not. I don't think there's any very convincing evidence that they do any good, but there's plenty of evidence they do harm.
Well, as a matter of fact, a company in your country, in England, is it Chiron? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes. Chiron. Yep.
They have had all kinds of problems. As a matter of fact, they now have to take a measles rubella vaccine off the market in Italy. It's harming children.
Right. Well, the point is, it's been doing this for a long time. It's difficult to just get the authorities to admit it. They're so scared in this sort of public health issue, you know, of pandemics and mass disease, and believe, quite faultily believe, that vaccination is the key to that, and therefore vaccination's reputation must be preserved at all costs. even at the cost of, you know, covering up things and telling lies. I just say that really vaccination isn't that effective, and there's no reason why. You know, if you look at the fact that all the major infective diseases have gradually disappeared over the last century, 90% of those diseases had disappeared before vaccination was ever implemented on a large scale. It's really due to things like a better environment and better nutrition. Vaccines have had almost no impact, and yet you can't get colleagues to see that. You know, they won't look at the demographics of it at all. Plus, there's a lot of fudging. You know, if somebody has been vaccinated and gets the disease, they say, oh, well, they couldn't have been vaccinated, so they alter them or put them in a category such as doubtful, because they're unable to admit that somebody who's had a vaccination could actually get the disease anyway. Once you start looking at that simple truth, then the whole thing becomes rather pointless.
What's your take on this avian flu, the bird flu?
Well, listen, we're going to spread into politics in a minute, because there's clearly more political hysteria than science in this. I, as a guest in your country, I don't really want to start raising issues like keeping the population frightened and subdued.
Fear.
And so on. But it seems to me pretty clear there's an awful lot of lies being told, and somebody must be benefiting from those lies.
But it's worldwide now, Keith.
Right. But, you know, it's supposed to kill like 50% of people, and it isn't doing that. You know, the actual death statistics are just nothing like people are touting. You know, an old or infirm person or a young child getting almost any kind of virus disease might die. So that makes it look bad and makes it look like a scary condition. But, you know, ordinary influenza, you know, which we don't recognize much as a pandemic. I mean, every 40 years or so we do. But people die of that simple disease if their body is not up to it. It's really more a condition of the terrain. In other words, one's own inner environment is really the issue, and not the, you know, the exterior issue of whether or not there are viruses or bacteria or parasites or things running around in our environment.
Well, you know, I am so glad that you're saying this, because I have said this now for the last year. You know, 98 people, they say, have died from this bird flu since 2003. 98 people in about 2.5 years, basically.
Yeah.
Yet they say 36,000 just in the United States die from the normal, ordinary flu every year, of which they're not even talking about this year. I mean, if we had 36,000 people die from the bird flu in this country, they'd panic.
Absolutely.
It's blown out of proportion.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You've been saying the right thing all along.
Well, of everything you have studied in this field of what I would call energy, bioenergy medicine, is there one area that just fascinates you the most?
It's a good chance to tell you about the area that currently fascinates me the most. I mean,
sure.
My whole life, I don't know what will end up at the top of the pile, but at this moment, I am most fascinated by a piece of sound technology, and it's called the vocal. Now, let's just explain that sound, we're talking energy healing. Sound is energy, so it's still energy healing. But sound is, of course, different to electromagnetic energy. For one thing, it needs a medium. It travels in air. It travels quite slowly compared to light, and it actually travels, it's about 700 and some miles an hour. We'll travel faster as air temperature rises, but travels about 5 times as fast in water, which is why, you know, you can hear, whales can hear their voices way across oceans. And so sound would have a peculiar impact on the human body, since we're 70% water. And sure enough, I've come across a device that has some really awesome impact. It has to do with repatterning the voice. The history of the technology goes back a ways. There's a Frenchman called Alfred Tomatis who in the 70s was experimenting with supplying missing frequency. He found something interesting, which is if a person couldn't hear a frequency, that frequency wouldn't be present in the person's voice. But if you supplied the missing frequency, then it also appeared in the person's voice. And sometimes, just sometimes, the person underwent an amazing psychological transformation. They were just very different. This has led to a whole voice patterning and repatterning technology. A lady called Sherry Edwards has become very famous for identifying just how much information is contained in the voice. For example, something like a melatonin deficiency or a vitamin mineral imbalance,
mm-hmm.
some kind of disease process, all that is actually present in the frequencies in the voice. But the particular device I'm excited about at the moment is one that goes further than that. What they're doing is repatterning a person's voice by getting a voice print and then playing it back to them through a device which is basically just a humble wooden chair, but bolted to that are a couple of big transducers and an amplifier. The person sat in a magnetic field. Now, you remember what I was saying about cyclotron resonance? if you're in a fixed magnet field and you get any kind of oscillation, then you're likely to bump into this cyclotron resonance frequency. So I knew immediately that the person was onto some interesting science. But what he found was that by repatterning a voice, a person is able to release extraordinary amounts of emotion. People would sometimes cry torrents and then feel tons better, you know, and 10 years younger. Not only that, but it began to lead to the fact that people are carrying around energetic patterns from their ancestors, particularly
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Keith, when we come back at the top of the hour. And it's time for your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.